Hello, everyone, and welcome to Spirit of Truth Church here for this talk on Apology Accepted about Biblical Archaeology 6, Leviticus through Deuteronomy. Now, tonight's not going to be too long. We are going to go through a number of different archaeological finds tonight, including one of the most interesting, I would argue, that's ever been seen. So without further ado, let's go ahead and jump right in. So first, I would like to simply read from Leviticus. We're going to start with Leviticus, Leviticus 16, 7 through 10. So let me go ahead and pull that up. Okay. All right, Leviticus 16, 7 through 10. Next, he will take the two goats and place them before the Lord at the entrance of the tent of meeting. After Aaron casts lots for the two goats, one lot for the Lord and the other one for Azazel, he is to present the goat chosen by lot for the Lord and sacrifice it as a sin offering. But the goat chosen by lot for Azazel is to be presented alive before the Lord to make purification with it by sending it into the wilderness for Azazel. Now, this scapegoats, it's interesting. There are many ancient Near Eastern parallels to this. It's a central part of Yom Kippur, the sending away of a goat to rid Israel of its national guilt. Now, these rites of riddance can be found among the Egyptians, the Canaanites, and the Ugaritic religion as well. So they have these things where they use the scapegoat ritual. They place guilt upon this goat and send it off in the wilderness. Babylon, the Akitu festival was very similar, and I'll go ahead and read you some of the similarities there now. Okay, so in that rite, you had the purification of a holy space as being combined with a propitiatory offering. You had priestly figures bathing beforehand, and some translations add they wore linen as Aaron did. Again, a slaughtered animal or its blood was used to purify the space. The deity was presented with roasted meat after cleansing. And interestingly enough, those who conduct the temple purification ritual would be made unclean, but in the Babylonian functionaries were temporarily banished, whereas the Aaron and temple functionaries were instructed to bathe. So it's interesting. You have these sort of all these parallels in the ancient times. This wasn't made up. This was something that people did back then, and obviously being done in the Jewish context, God ordaining that to be done, is fine. There's no reason why God can't use that, and other religions couldn't use something similar. Again, the purpose for it is what God has stated it is for in the context of Israel. Now, continuing on, there's this interesting comment about the for Azazel that a lot of people again get into. And what this means is, though, again, people tried to make this out to be just about the wilderness. They tried to make Azazel just be essentially, oh, yeah, it's just a symbol for the wilderness. But it actually does seem like it's referencing an actual demon. Okay, this would be the demon of the desert. Again, the wilderness is where demons reside. And the thought behind this is that the sins of the community would be carried by the goat and returned to this demon for the purpose of removing them from the community and leaving them at their source in order that their power or effect in the community might be completely broken. So again, it's this idea that the sin is going out, and it's almost being judged in a sense, or God is allowing it to be judged through this demon. And the thought would even be that the demon would essentially kill the goat or something would happen. So it's kind of fascinating that there's even like a death of that thing. The sins are gone, which is kind of cool. So we have that. And then let's go ahead and move into Numbers. And this is probably the most interesting archaeological find, I would argue, ever. One of the most significant, anyway. And it has a really cool story to it as well. This is Numbers 6, 24 through 26. So I'll go ahead and read that now. May Yahweh bless you and protect you. May Yahweh make his face shine on you and be gracious to you. May Yahweh look with favor on you and give you peace. Now, why is that interesting? Well, there's a guy. I'm going to go ahead and read you the story here. I'm going to read you the story. There's this archaeologist in 1979. He was Israeli. His name was Gabriel Barke. And he was excavating an archaeological site near Jerusalem's old city in the Hinnom Valley. And this site was called Ketef Hinnom. Okay, it's adjacent to St. Andrew's Church, again. Now, what's fascinating is that this is a massive rock-hewn complex. There's tons of natural caves, tons of tombs, just a lot of stuff there. And the thought was that this was pretty much excavated. But there was one tomb, tomb number 25, that was preserved intact because the lining of the roof of the cave was collapsed and it covered the floor of the cave with a thick deposit that essentially made it look like it was empty. And so the contents had been protected from tomb robbers. So when they excavated this cave, they recovered more than 1,000 objects. This was a massive find, beyond belief. And this included things like pottery vessels, iron and bronze arrowheads, needles and pins, bone and ivory objects, jewelry. I mean, you name it, they found it. It was insane how much was in here. And when it was done, they almost overlooked these two things. They looked like used cigarettes. Okay, like burned up ashy cigarettes. So they initially thought, one of the comments was they thought, oh, well, maybe they were, you know, left by the workers or something. But here's the thing. They took them anyway. They cataloged them anyway. And what they found out is they weren't cigarettes. They were actually silver. They were silver scrolls. And I'll go ahead and just show you here. This is the cave. I'll show you a picture of the cave here. Give me one second. There's a picture of the guy with the cave. And then I'll show you this. Give me one second. That's the picture of the silver scroll, unopened. So when they opened them, they stretched out like this. And lo and behold, what was on the scrolls? But numbers. Numbers 6, 24 through 26. It was a priestly benediction. And these scrolls, here's the real crazy thing. These scrolls had the priestly benediction written on them, and they date back to 587 BC. Now, why is that number significant? Well, first off, remember, you have the Masoretic text, which is around 900 AD. And then the next section of text, which again includes a lot of the Old Testament, came from the Dead Sea Scrolls. That was found in 100 BC, and they're very similar to the MT. That backed it up about 1,000 years. This backs it up a further 480 years. Again, pretty good agreement with the other texts we have. And this is now the earliest portion of scripture or the manuscript we have in history. This is it, 587 BC. That is the earliest document in scripture that we have. And why it's even more interesting is because if it was around here, this is the end of the first temple period. The documentary hypothesis, or JEPD, states that, well, the Torah, none of the Bible is even written until post-exile. But here we have Torah, at least a piece of it, dating to First Temple. So this struck at the heart of the JEPD, of the documentary hypothesis theory. And again, it just goes to show, when scholars say, well, we know, why would you ever believe something so stupid as the Bible was written by who it says it was, and it was early written, and it wasn't? We would say, well, look, every time you state that so emphatically, we come up with something like this, which disproves your entire theory. And yet this is very rarely ever talked about. So it's interesting and very important, I would argue, that this find essentially runs right into that documentary hypothesis and says, no way, Jose, you've got at least the Torah in proof in the first temple period. So that is a really exciting find. Next, we've got something that comes from Numbers 22 through 24. And what this essentially is the account of is Balaam, son of Beor's prophecy. Okay, and I'll read you a small segment. Balak sent messengers to summon Balaam, son of Beor, who is at Pethor near the Euphrates River in his native land. Balak said, a people has come out of Egypt. They cover the face of the land and have settled next to me. Now come and put a curse on these people because they are too powerful for me. Perhaps then I'll be able to defeat them and drive them out of the land. For I know that whoever you bless is blessed and whoever you curse is cursed. Okay, so here's the interesting thing about this is we actually have a text that's dated to about 840 to 760 BC. And what it is, it's a record of a possibly extra-biblical oracle from Balaam. Now, it'd be earlier, obviously, much earlier in terms of the thing, but we have the manuscript from that time. Okay, and I'll just go ahead and read you some of this. It actually says, the sayings of Balaam, son of Beor, the man who was a seer of the gods. Lo, gods came to him in the night and spoke to him. According to the words, they said to Balaam, son of Beor, thus let someone make it hereafter so what you have heard may be seen. And then he rose in the morning and wept. And so you have this entire whole thing of, you know, the Shadean have taken their place in the assembly and said, so the sky is shut with your thick cloud, but there be a darkness and no perpetual shining and no radiance, for you'll put a seal upon the thick cloud of darkness, and you will not remove it forever. For the swift has reproached the eagle. The voice of vultures resounds. The stork has the young of the bird and ripped up the chicks of the heron. The swallow is belittled. So you have these curses, essentially, from Balaam. So it's interesting that we have extra biblical record of this Balaam son of Beor person in history. Very cool stuff. So again, pretty exciting. And though it dates several centuries after the time of Balaam, it may preserve an extra-biblical oracle of the prophet. So, again, thought that was kind of cool as well, that we have at least something historically mentioning him. And then Numbers 21:8 through 9, this is the bronze serpent. So what's fascinating about the bronze serpent in Scripture is the bronze serpent, they held it up, right? So here's the account. The Lord said to Moses, make a snake and put it up on a pole. Anyone who's bitten can look at it and live. And so Moses made a bronze serpent and put it up on a pole. And when anyone was bitten by a snake and looked on the bronze snake, they lived. Now, what's interesting is that there is a snake in the desert of Israel today, and it's called a seraph, or fiery, because it has a fatal bite that burns like fire and brings death. And what's interesting is that you essentially see this poisonous snake kind of cult come about. Now, what's fascinating is by the time of King Hezekiah in 715 to 687 BC, This brazen thing, the Nehushtan, had become a cult object, and so actually he destroyed it. So it's fascinating. No longer served the original purpose of memorializing divine deliverance. It now became an object of worship, and so Hezekiah destroyed it. And there are tons of these bronze snakes, tons of them, in Hazor, Megiddo, Tel Mavorak, Shechem, Gezer, and the Midianite shrine at Timnah. Tons of these bronze snakes, and I'll go ahead and show you a picture of those as well. And so again, we have kind of an interesting biblical confirmation that, yeah, this is a thing that was done in the time. It was the snake cult. And that's why Hezekiah destroyed it in Israel. And whether it came from Moses or not, I mean, you know, but at least it was introduced through God as the symbol of deliverance, though it quickly lost it. Okay. And then finally, Numbers 21:13 just talks about Arnon as a territorial border. And I just want to mention this again briefly. Arnon is a territorial border. That's been found. Okay, we know where this is, the territorial border, and it's actually a really important place because before the Hebrew period separated the Moabites from the Amorites, and after the Hebrew settlement, it divided, theoretically, quote, at least, Moab from the tribes of Reuben and Gad. And so here's, again, a picture of that. Pretty cool. Very, very neat. That whole region is just fascinating. The land layout and the rock formations and things is breathtaking. All right, and let's go ahead then and move into... I want to talk about the Mesha inscription as well. So the Mesha inscription is another worthwhile... we should take a look at it. And essentially, the Mesha inscription... And I'm going to go ahead and get one of my other books here real quick. Let me go ahead and read from the Mesha inscription here specific. Give me just one moment. If I can find this. Let's see here, Mesha inscription. But this is a pretty cool one. Where is it? Okay, there's the Marineptestella. I need the Mesha, M-E. Yes. Mesha Stella, there it is. All right, 158. All right, let's get the Mesha Stella here. All right, the Mesha Stella, origin year 850. So again, this is in the monarchy period. Okay, and what it has on it is it has Moabite-Israelite relations in the 9th century, King Ahab and King David mentioned. So let me go ahead and see if I can get a full reading of this. 163, let me see. It's pretty neat. All right, here it is. Okay, Mesha Stella. So, okay, with the discovery, I'll go ahead and read here for you. With the discovery of Tel Dan Stella in 1983, we talked about that before. The extreme minimalist view of Ushakin and the others was challenged since the phrase House of David was found there. So, right, the Tel Dan Stella had House of David on it. Now, David's reign has also now been identified on line 31 of the Mesha Stella. Amihai Mazar described the implication of the discovery. It means that about 140 years after the presumed end of David's reign, David was well known as the founder of the dynasty that ruled a kingdom in Jerusalem. So again, this is very exciting stuff in terms of, again, another indication of David, another indication of Ahab, all on the Mesha inscription as well. Now, for our last thing that I want to take a look at is something that many people actually are more familiar with, and this is the covenants, the suzerain treaty covenant. So here's an example of a suzerain treaty covenant. I'll go ahead and put this up here. That's what it would look like. And this is, again, this one is specifically from, it's a Hittite suzerain treaty between Tudhaliya, the fourth Egyptian, and Kurunta of Tarhuntasa, the Hittite. Okay. And so, again, let's talk a little bit about what these suzerain treaties are and why they're important to Deuteronomy specifically. Okay, so in Deuteronomy, what we have is we have essentially a covenant between God and Israel. Now, in these, so in the suzerain vassal treaty format, you'd have a preamble, and this would essentially identify the suzerain by his name and titles, or the leader. Now, again, the suzerain. So the parallel in Deuteronomy is Moses is the covenant mediator, essentially. Okay, that's how it starts out. Then you have historical prologue. This is where you would have the suzerain's dealings with the vassal, and to illustrate how much the suzerain has done for the vassal to protect and establish it. And therefore, the vassal owes its submission and allegiance to the suzerain. Now, this is very clear. Moses' first sermon, historical review, this is all that God's done for you. I mean, it's very clear that God is the key piece in this. Then there's the general stipulations. The next section of these treaties lists the stipulations, what the vassal's required to do, and what the suzerain offers in return. Again, that's handled in the second sermon, part A of the covenant obligations. Again, here's the law, basically. Then there's the specific stipulations. There may be a requirement that the vassal deposit his copy of the treaty in his temple, where he's supposed to read it and study to refresh his memory. And again, this is in Moses' second sermon. They have to read the law regularly, and it's going to be stored in the Ten Commandments, especially restored in the Ark. There's the divine witness. So deities were called to witness the treaty. And then Moses calls on heaven and earth to witness, since Yahweh is the only divine. And then finally, there's the blessings and the curses. The last section of these treaties contains the blessings if the vassal obeys, and the curses if the vassal is unfaithful, and we know that very clearly. Moses' third sermon, the blessings and the curses, fourth sermon, covenant summary, and then finally the succession of the covenant mediator from Moses to Joshua. So we literally have a suzerain treaty. There's no question about it. That's exactly what this is, which is kind of exciting. Again, this would come in this format. The people would have been familiar with this most likely. And it was a great way to deliver it. So again, this really sets it in the time of that people. Again, this is all, it's not anachronistic. This is very much in the time of the people. This is how they would have done things. So very cool stuff from archaeology regarding that. And with that, that's the last piece. It's a little bit shorter one. Again, we just had a couple things left to go over. Couple things left to go over tonight. And so that's kind of all I wanted to say. I'll go ahead and open a Zoom call here for anybody who would like to discuss archaeology in general a little bit more. But other than that, this has been a very fun series, and we actually just wrapped up both our archaeology and our other book series. We'll see. I may be taking a week off. I don't know. So for those of you who are listening or who hear this and you're wondering, hey, is he beyond this next week? Just look for the posts. I'll post the next series of lectures once I get them straight and are set out. And I look forward to getting to talk with some of you after this. Let me go ahead and open the Zoom, see if anybody wants to chat. And again, the Zoom link is going to be posted here. Okay, go ahead and do this. Okay, and invite link. Okay, so here's the link. And again, we can talk archaeology if you'd like. So there it is. All right, so there's the link. Feel free to join in. I'll let you in. It'll probably put you in a waiting room. I'll let you in momentarily once I'm done. Going through my little outro. So thank you so much again for joining us here at Spirit of Truth Outreach for our little talk here on Biblical Archaeology, Leviticus through Deuteronomy. I hope you enjoyed. Hope this whole series has been fun. There's a lot of, again, this is the sixth part in the series. I hope this whole series has been fun to learn about a little bit about Biblical Archaeology every other week. And I look forward to doing more later. We will be covering the rest of the Old Testament, the intertestamental period, the New Testament at some point. I'm probably going to be doing these throughout the year and in the years to come, and just kind of giving these as, you know, anywhere from 4 to 6 week increments where we do a little bit more archaeology and just kind of update people on what's going on. So again, looking forward to that, and I hope to see